Hello, everyone. My name is Philip Clayton. Welcome to another episode of the podcast, Conversations for a Life Economy. This series is brought to you by the British charity Reboot the Future and by the Institute for Ecological Civilization, ecociv.org. The most universal ethical principle in history is called the Golden Rule. Treat others as you wish to be treated. What would it mean to extend this idea to the environment? Today's guest, John Perkins, has famously called the result a life economy, that is, living in ways that foster mutually beneficial relationships between human activities and the environment, driven by the goal of maximizing long-term benefits for both people and the planet. Each podcast episode in this series features a significant leader who's working toward this goal. We explore the values and experiences that drive their work, the transformations they are working toward, and the ways that listeners can succeed at similar initiatives in their own lives. Today, we take a deep dive into the theory and practice of a life economy. We're excited to have as our guest today, John Perkins, the originator of the life economy concept. John's work was an inspiration for this podcast series and for many of the discussions we've been hosting over the last few months. A word about John. John Perkins is an internationally known speaker and activist and the author of more than 10 books covering a wide range of topics: economics, politics and global intrigue, shamanism, and the path to societal transformation and an ecological civilization. Among John's books are Touching the Jaguar, Shapeshifting, and of course his classic Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which was on the New York Times bestseller list for more than 70 weeks, sold over 2 million copies, and has been published in 37 languages. As chief economist at a major consulting firm, John advised the World Bank, United Nations, Fortune 500 corporations, the US and other governments. He has been initiated as a shaman in the Amazonian and Andean indigenous cultures. John has lectured at Harvard, Oxford, and more than 50 other universities, as well as at economic forums and shamanic gatherings around the world. He is a founder and board member of the nonprofit organizations, the Pachamama Alliance and Dream Change, and a recipient of the Lenin Ono Peace Prize. And now let me introduce Grace Okafor, the host of today's podcast.
Thank you, Philip, and welcome to the podcast, John. So we're really excited to have you on today. You have a really incredible background and story, and you've had a variety of life-changing events that I imagine have greatly influenced what you've done over the course of your career and your commitment to the work that you're doing as it relates to realizing a life economy. So before we get into the details of unpacking and really exploring these ideas, I want to foster a space for folks to understand you as a person and to also gain a better sense of those transformative experiences that put you on this journey and mission to, for lack of a better word, really subvert how individuals independently and collectively can transform our current systems of business and capitalism. So let's go back in time to your earliest days. So you grew up in rural New Hampshire. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience?
Well, sure, Grace. And first of all, thank you. Thank you, Philip, for that overly long introduction. And Grace, for having me here. And I want to make one little correction, Philip, and that is, although I love the term life economy, it originated thousands of years ago. You know, I don't know that they called it that, but I think it's important for us all to understand that for the 200,000 or 250,000 years, something in that area that we've considered ourselves as humans, almost all that time, we practiced the life economy. It's only been in the relatively recent history that we've moved to this death economy. We can talk more about that later. But yeah, I grew up in rural New Hampshire in a small town that was broke. It had been a mill town, and the mills had all gone bust. And so I went to school for first through eighth grade in this very poor town. I lived on the hill in a boys' private boarding school where my dad taught. And My dad didn't make any money, basically. The school gave us a house and food, and he got a good pension, but we were cash short. It didn't really need cash, but I was surrounded with extremely wealthy boys from all over the world. And, all my life, I heard about the stories from Buenos Aires and Paris and London and New York, Wall Street, Park Avenue. And then every day through eighth grade, I would go downtown and go to the local public school where I was mingling with kids whose parents were at the opposite end of the spectrum. It was amazing education, actually. And then for high school, after eighth grade, I went to the prep school where my dad taught. And again, was surrounded by these wealthy kids. And, they'd go home for a vacation, Christmas vacation. And they'd come back with these phenomenal stories about the parties they'd been in, the orgies they'd had, and so on and so forth. Probably a lot of them were exaggerations, but there was an element of truth in all of that. And I'd spent my Christmas vacation in the prep school gymnasium that my father had a key to, shooting baskets by myself, or hitting a tennis ball against the wall, getting ready for tennis season. It had a huge impact on me. It made me be very desirous of the kind of life I was hearing from these prep school kids. It sounded a lot better than the lives of the kids in the town that I'd grown up with, better than my life. And I think that story will probably evolve as we talk, but that had a major impact on me during the time when I was an economic hitman.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for sharing that. I would kind of be interested to get a deeper sense of this kind of impact that this almost this isolation of this very kind of rural space and environment had on you as a person, and what that may have suggested what you might do later on in life. And I know we're going to probably talk about Peace Corps and a little bit of things like that. But what about the natural landscape and about living around people who didn't necessarily align with where you were coming from a socioeconomic status? What did that mean to you and your development?
Very interesting question, Grace, because the kids in the prep school mainly came from urban areas. And the kids I grew up with were woodsmen. The mills had gone bankrupt. So many of their parents, their fathers were lumberjacks, and often just sort of the private lumberjacks. They'd cut firewood for wealthier people, and he got a living that way. And they knew the woods, and I used to hang out in the woods with them. And then on summer vacation, my dad would get about 3 months off. We had a little cottage that my grandfather had built in New Hampshire on a lake in the forest. And we had no neighbors in those days. And I was an only child. And my mom spent a lot of time painting. My dad spent a lot of time gardening. They didn't pay much attention to me. I would spend my days in the woods or out on the lake in a canoe or a raft I built. But a lot of the time I was in the woods, I was talking to the trees, and they were my friends. I was lonely, and they were my friends. You can probably hear my cat in the background. She's my friend now. She's always talking to me. So I apologize if she enters the conversation, but that's who she is. Thank you, come here. And so, I would later understand that I was practicing shamanism before I'd ever heard of shamanism. I was relating to the spirit of the trees and the plants and the forest because I was lonely. And it was also a time when I started writing because on rainy days, the three of us were shut in this little cabin together, and my mom and dad would have their projects that they would continue to do. But I would create my own stories, create my own life. I started by drawing stick figure cartoons and then got into writing short stories as I got older. So it was a very molding time in my life.
Yeah, I can imagine just even the New England landscape being something that is very like fantastical. I spent a week in rural Vermont, and I remember being from the city and like going to that kind of space, feeling so restored, but also having a deeper understanding of the things that filled me up inside and being able to really explore that and have that exploration. I think this also really kind of segues into some interesting topics, and what you just described kind of brings up a lot of different ideas in my mind, especially on the concept of like ecocentrism, where it's this attitude that the natural world is sentient, is almost equal to humans. And I think this segues really well into your time in that I'd love to chat about your time in Peace Corps in South America, which my understanding of Peace Corps is that a lot of people come back feeling really changed and having grown a lot. And I'd be curious to know, what was your experience like being a Peace Corps volunteer in South America?
Well, it was, yes, it was a totally transformative experience. I asked for the Amazon and got it. And I asked for it because, you know, again, as a kid growing up in New Hampshire, I was very aware of the Abnaki, Algonquin-speaking people that had lived on the land that I now lived on, and their tremendous relationship with the forest, with nature. And I used to spend some time with an old Abnaki man who I was discouraged from spending time with him because he was considered drunk and dangerous. And he did drink a lot, but he wasn't dangerous in any way. He was a great teacher. And so I knew that the only part of the world where people still lived kind of like the Abnaki had lived was in the Amazon. So I requested it and got it. And, you know, there I found people who were living very, very much as the Abnaki had lived in pre-colonial days, or the transition was going on during the American Revolution and the French and Indian War. So and I found a people who did talk to the trees, who knew the trees were equal to humans, and in fact, even better. I mean, one of the things that the Shuar people who I was living with would tell me was, you know, being a human being is not all that great. We have many lives, and we come as humans because we've got something to learn about discipline. And because we're so powerful, we can kill birds, we can kill animals, we can kill forests. We're the only species that can really do such things. And we've got to learn how not to do that and still survive. That's why we come as humans. But when you die, you don't want to come back as a human. You want to come back as a tree. And I've been pointing at this huge tree that grows in the forest there and say that would be good. Or a jaguar, a big cat. An anaconda. That's a good thing to come back as. You don't want to come back as a human, though. Hopefully you've learned your lesson here at this time.
Thank you for sharing. That sounds so amazing. And, you know, again, this is kind of bringing up a lot of these ideas of, it's almost like a very deeply spiritual experience that you've had both in New Hampshire and then in Peace Corps. And it's almost a little bit bittersweet to think that a lot of folks are in our immediate society aren't really able to have to engage in the world in this way. And you've had this very powerful opportunity to kind of, you know, go into different communities who are engaging with the world and viewing the natural world as an equal and as an entity that is deserving of respect and belonging and stewardship. Looking back on and your Peace Corps time, and even we can talk about your time in New Hampshire, what values and ideas do you think were planted that served and have motivated your decisions throughout your career?
You know, I think one of the reasons I became an economic hitman, and I thought I was chief economist at this consulting firm. That was my official title. And in the beginning, for many years, I did that for 10 years. And for probably well over half of those years, I believed that what I was doing was the right thing. Because that's what we're taught in business school, that you want to burden a country, get a country take on lots of debt from the World Bank and hire our corporations to build power plants and industrial parks and other infrastructure projects in that country. And the country, you know, will benefit because statistically we can show that it does. Our metrics for measuring such things are gross domestic product or gross national product. And you can show that when you increase infrastructure like that, the GDP grows. It does. But over time, I began to see that only reflected the life of the rich, because they're what make up GDP. And it's true in the United States, too, where three individuals have as much wealth as half the half of our country. You know, so if they're doing well and the other people aren't doing so well, it still looks like the country's doing well. But it took a long time to understand that. And I think part of how I came to understand that, whereas many people in the business never do, is because of my time with the indigenous people, because I had lived with the people who were downstream from the dams that were being built, because I would live with people who were being destroyed by oil and mining. And yet those were the very things that were increasing GDP, and the roads going into the jungle and the industries and so on, and the big electric grids that supplied electricity to the wealthy, but not to most other people. So it was, you know, I think that experience in the Peace Corps helped guide me later in life to reject the death economy that I was in the process of creating, to understand that it was a death economy.
So we've been talking about life economy and a death economy in a very kind of broad anecdotal ways. And I'd be interested to concretely define these terms for our audience that's still a little bit unclear about what do they mean. So, John, can you share the deeper story behind the life and death economy and kind of describe the kind of antagonistic traits of what differentiates one from another?
Yes, Grace. So first of all, the death economy, we'll break them down. The death economy has a goal of maximizing short-term profits for a relative few. And it also has a goal, we all have sort of given the goal of maximizing our materialistic consumption. But the big goal is maximizing short-term profits of big corporations. And it's based on fear and the debt to gain market share and political control. It promotes the idea that for someone to win, another person must lose. It's predatory, encouraging businesses to prey on each other and people and the environment. It destroys resources needed for its own long-term survival. And it values goods and services that are extractive and materialistic above those that enhance quality of life. So in other words, it doesn't really honor child rearing and the arts. And a lot of things that typically, frankly, women have done over the years are that they're undervalued because you can't assign a dollar value to that, or that we didn't think we could assign it. And it's also heavily influenced by non-productive financial deals like stock manipulation and gambling, financialization, you might call it gambling. And it ignores the externalities. Like environmental destruction and exploitation of workers when we're measuring profits and when we're measuring GDP and other metrics. And it also, like its name implies, it's heavily militarized. It thrives on killing or threatening to kill and other people and life forms and destroying infrastructure. You know, in the United States, our economy is very, very dependent on the military these days. And so it causes pollution and environmental collapse and drastic income, social inequality, on and on and on. There's a whole, the list goes on and on. But basically what we can say is that it's consuming itself into extinction. It can't continue. It's causing climate change. It's causing income inequality. It's causing species extinctions. It's causing most of the crises that we're facing today on our planet. I think you could say that it is the root cause behind the pandemic in its own way. That's a complex subject that we probably don't want to get into right now, but it's really the root cause behind so many of the problems that we face. That's the death economy. You want me to go on with the life economy now?
Absolutely. And in your kind of explanation of the life economy, I'd be curious to know, what are the most important features to you personally when you're kind of thinking about this vision of a life economy in our societies?
Well, the life economy the life economy, in contrary to the death economy, it's based on long-term rather than short-term benefits for people and nature. And it serves a public interest. And the public interest includes nature, so the commons. So it has laws that support level playing fields and encourage healthy, non-monopolistic competition and so on and so forth. And it values life, and it values it includes the externality. So when you have to figure out profits, like if an oil company is figuring out its profits in the death economy, it doesn't have to take into account the terrible destruction it might be causing in the Amazon to people and nature. Those are not accounted for. In a life economy, you'd have to account for those. What is that worth? What does it cost to clean up all of that? In today's world, often it never has to be cleaned up, but you have to take that into account. So a life economy really pays people to clean up pollution, for example. It's not a stagnant economy. People say, well, wait a minute, does this mean we're not gonna have any growth? Not at all. It means we're gonna have growth in areas that clean up pollution. And we're gonna create jobs cleaning up pollution and regenerating destroyed environments, recycling, and creating new technologies that don't ravage the earth. You know, and frankly, Grace, we've been heading in that direction for quite a few years now. Not a lot of years, but probably we could say during this millennium, especially the latter part of it, where we've got into B corporations, benefit corporations, the Green New Deal, these kinds of things that we're looking at more and more and more, that people are beginning to really understand the importance of maximizing things that serve the long-term interests of the forests and the animals and the plants as well as us, because let's face it, we can't live without all that. We wouldn't want to live without all that, and we can't live without all that.
Yeah, I think this is kind of bringing up what is kind of the application of the life economy. So we've kind of talked about the ideas more broadly speaking. And so I want to investigate the phase that goes between ideation to application. So how do you conceive this process of transformation from the death economy to a life economy? And clearly we've kind of talked about like emerging technologies, innovative solutions to issues as it relates to sustainability and the climate crisis. But what are some other ways that are steps that our society can achieve this transformation from the death to the life economy?
Let me give what I think is a classic example. For 2 years before the pandemic, I gave lectures at something called the Colors of Ostrava, which is a festival that takes place in Ostrava, the Czech Republic. And 50,000 people come to this festival. There's a lot of great musicians, world-class musicians that come and speakers. Ostrava was at one time known as the heart of steel for the Soviet Union. And the whole city was built around a huge coal mine that directly fed a huge steel plant. And not long after the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1991, the mine ran out of coal, essentially, or affordable coal. The steel plant shut down, the mine shut down, everything shut down. The town went into total decline, very much like the mill town I'd grown up in New Hampshire. And yet this is a huge city in the Czech Republic, what is now the Czech Republic. The people of that city decided, well, what, we put these huge structures, let's turn them into auditoriums and stages. And they have this beautiful auditorium that was at one time this huge tank, grand, huge tank, sort of structure that, and now it's a beautiful auditorium with sloped seats, padded seats, and a great stage where I spoke on that stage. You know, they did a magnificent job. They created a beautiful example of the life economy where people come and make music and poetry and literature. And they have this whole section where people like me go and speak about the importance of transformation. And they had quantum physicists. They had a couple of friends of mine, indigenous people from the Amazon, came and spoke, and all kinds of people, environmentalists, politicians. So it's an example of one of the things that can be done. And, you know, I think we can look at that as sort of as a microcosm for the world, but every local community has to take a look at what can it contribute in a better way. And so it's hard to be specific, but from a global standpoint, we have to say, for one thing, we've got to stop measuring progress by GDP. The metrics that we use today are metrics that are totally geared toward the rich. They're meant to show how the world prospers when the rich get richer and more powerful. And it's totally false. The world does not prosper. Trickle-down economics does not work. We've seen that in recent years here, you know. It just doesn't work. It doesn't trickle down. It stays up there for the most part. And, you know, one example is that in the United States, the middle class has gone from 60% to 50% since 1973. And there hasn't been an increase in real wages, when you account for inflation, since 1973 in the real average wage in the United States. That's a terrible indictment on us. In the meantime, the numbers of billionaires has skyrocketed. Multimillionaires has really skyrocketed, and billionaires have come into existence in that period of time. Amazing. You know, another example, these days, China is not very popular, but it is the subject of my next book. And one of the things for the Winter the recent Olympics that were held in China, you know, that most of that, the Olympic venue was energized by extremely efficient alternative energy, non-polluting energy. We always hear about the coal plants in China and so on, and all of that's there. But China's also been doing a great deal to improve its use of solar and wind and other alternative energy sources. Much of the world is doing this. You know, we're seeing countries like Costa Rica that are practically fossil free, not completely fossil free. And there are many examples around the world.
Yeah, I think this is painting a very kind of clear picture about what a life economy looks like in practice, right? So it's a society where effectively institutions and entities are actively being held responsible for creating equitable exchanges for all parties involved without the risk of harm. And this is, you know, communities, this is businesses, and this is also the environment. One thing that does come to mind, and I can't help but think about how values play a role in people's behaviors and actions to either be indifferent or like an active participant to change. So the life economy sounds very much like a challenging, altruistic undertaking. And I'm having a hard time compartmentalizing how do we get to that end goal of communities that are life economy aligned. I'm thinking about how that requires some transformation on a personal level and also on a social and cultural level to really bring about change. So I guess my question is, I'd be curious to understand the ways that you believe societies can initiate a narrative change that help individuals adopt a perspective that is more life economy aligned. And what are other methods that folks can participate in that are changing the dominant narrative to what we should value on a personal level?
You raise the most important point of all there, Grace. It's reality is molded by our perceptions. We know that. We know that there is no United States. There's no China. There's no culture. There's no religion. There are no corporations until somebody perceives of these things, and then when enough people accept a perception or codify it into law, it has a huge impact on reality. And the perception that I grew up with, and that has been the dominant one throughout all of my lifetime, has been that to be successful, you got to make money. Or at the very least, you've got to make enough money to live, you know, better than most people, you know, upper middle class. And this is our definition of success, and it's molded our values, and those have created a reality of extreme materialism. And you know, if I want to get myself out of this little New Hampshire town, then I have the opportunity to go out and become a chief economist and exploit other countries I better take it. When I decided that I no longer wanted to do that, when I understood the evil that I was doing in the world, I decided, when I thought about getting out, there was tremendous pressure on me not to get out from my bosses and the people who worked for me also. But at the same time, inside of me, I didn't want to believe what I knew to be true, because I was making a great salary. I finally was traveling first class to these places I'd heard about all my life, from these wealthy kids at the school that my dad taught, to Paris and London and Tehran and everywhere. And I was flying first class and staying in the best hotels and wining and dining with presidents and beautiful women. And the whole, you know, it was just like, it was the American dream. And I thought, and so this pressure, this perception that I was successful. But I also then realized that I was essentially living on alcohol and Valium, that I was not happy, and that I would be flying off to Indonesia for, and at one point in time, I made 12 trips from Boston to Jakarta, Indonesia, 12 trips in a period of less than 3 months. That's exhausting. And, you know, I would spend the night in Hong Kong before going to Indonesia the next day. And I would arrive in Hong Kong late at night. I would immediately go to the bar, drink heavily, and then take Valium. And in the morning, I have to load myself up with caffeine just to get to the airport. And then I'd be in a meeting negotiating deals for what today would be billions of dollars. And I realized I was miserable. I was making a lot of money. I was living the American dream, and I was miserable. So that perception of what it means to be happy changed for me. I'm very happy now. I live in a pretty tiny house, and you know, I still travel a bit. But I don't usually travel first class unless I've got enough points to do so. And I only travel. I'm very careful not to use airplanes unless I think I'm going to do something that's really going to help change a larger perception. If I'm going to speak to a crowd of several thousand people and try to help them understand the importance of transforming the death economy to a life economy, then it's maybe worth the jet fuel that I use to get there. But otherwise, I'm not going to do it. You know, I take the vacations walking in the woods here. So my perception changed. And I think that's what we all need. And if we can put on the covers of our magazines the people who are moving toward a life economy instead of the ones that are running the big corporations that continue to exploit people, then that's where we've got to go. And we all must participate in this. All of us, every one of us must understand the importance of doing this.
That, I think that is a kind of very fantastic way to put it, because I think there's this gradual shift that's happening where people are really, and the pandemic kind of initiated that, this reevaluation of what is success? What brings me joy? What brings me fulfillment? How am I engaging with my community to make a difference? And having those conversations is a big part of kind of initiating that change. On the topic of initiating change, I want to talk about two of the nonprofits that you helped found and are involved with that are in line with this concept of a life economy. So correct me if I mispronounce this wrong, but there's the Pachamama Alliance and Dream Change. Both of which have a focus on and building on Indigenous lifeways and knowledge towards change. For our audience, could you describe in one to two sentences what both of the organizations are tasked in doing, as it is tangentially related to this movement, and perhaps the ways that they may complement each other despite being separate engagements and organizations?
Yeah, so I think both organizations are aimed at creating a, you know, an environmentally sustainable, socially just and spiritually fulfilling world. And that's in fact part of the mission statement of the Pachamama Alliance, but it draws from Dream Change, which was started first by me and under the guidance of Indigenous people back in the late 80s, when they told me that the only way to save the Amazon is not to come there and try to change what's going on there, but to change our people, ultimately, to change the dream of the modern world, which is what's consuming the things that are being mined and drilled for oil and trees cut and so on and so forth. All of that is driven by our dream of bigger buildings and more cars, heavy industry, and we need to change that dream. And so Dream Change has had this view of of changing people's dreams around the world. We've done many projects, and there you can go to them on the dreamchange.org website if people are interested. But over the years, since the 80s, we've done a lot of amazing things. And they were all guided by very small staff that we've had over the years, and the idea being to generate people to do what they dream. So I'd be speaking at a conference, and somebody would come up to me and say, "Hey, don't you think we should do this, this, this?" And I'd say, "Yeah, that's a great idea. It's your dream. You make it happen. And if you need to have the help of a nonprofit organization, contact us. But you got to take the leadership on this. It's your dream. So change the dream, you know, and you do it." And it was very successful. And out of that, one of the dreams that wanted to be changed was that of Bill and Lynn Twist, who since have run on a day-to-day basis the Pachamama Alliance. I'm a founder and I'm on the board, but they've run with their dream of working specifically today to save the sacred headwaters of the Amazon. Because the whole, you know, a fifth of the world's fresh water flows through the Amazon, and five times that amount goes up through the trees through absorption of water into the atmosphere that then circles the planet and has a huge impact. So Pachamama Alliance is very focused on changing the dream that's destroying the Amazon. You get this kind of an overlap there, but I will say Pachamama Alliance has a lot more people involved in doing that. So the whole process of dream change has been for us to stay small and encourage people to do what they most want to do. So you guys are working very hard, you and Philip and many others, on creating this ecological civilization. And the life economy is part of that. It's a foundation for the ecological civilization. And that's your dream, and so that you're doing that. And there's people all over the world that are buying into this new dream of creating an environmentally sustainable, socially just, and spiritually fulfilling world, or one aspect of one or the other of those.
This is just such a fulfilling conversation, and this kind of brings me to my second to last point that I wanted to ask, because you brought up a really interesting topic of when you kind of went back to visit those communities in South America and the Amazon, that, you know, their suggestion and their response was go help the people that are kind of encouraging this destruction to happen, right? Change your attitudes and change your behaviors and actions as it relates to our communities and the lands that we steward. And I think I'm curious to understand about thinking about the pivoting the responsibility on folks who are more kind of complicit in this wider discussion of carbon footprints, especially people in first world countries who have a higher carbon footprint than people in, you know, sub-Saharan Africa and South America, indigenous communities all over the world. How do we live in reconciliation with nature, despite being so far removed from it? You know, a lot of the people who are living in urban dwellings and city spaces don't have that kind of attachment and connection. How do we kind of create that space where we're expanding this way of thinking of a life economy to create more impact? And what are some of the indigenous life ways that you think could be adopted to non-indigenous people around the world?
I think it's really important for people in cities to understand that their cities are nature. Concrete, cement, it all comes from nature. You know, it's sand and lime and it's all part of nature. I recall the first time I ever brought a shaman from the Amazon to New York. We were headed down to speak at a center in New York City, and I had the driver leave the airport and drive us to Central Park, because I thought the shaman would want to really, I wanted to show him the trees of New York City. We get to Central Park, and he doesn't go to the trees. He goes across the street and puts his hands up against this huge building. And he comes back from it and he says, "This building has good energy." And I said, "Oh my gosh, really?" And he said, "Yeah, didn't you know that?" And I said, "Well, I didn't think about it. He said, "Do people who live in that building, do they know that? Is that why they live in the building?" And I said, "I don't think most of them think that way." And he looked at me and he said, "You guys must be in trouble, because everything has spirit. And that says so very much. So, you know, if you're sitting on the 50th floor of a skyscraper in Chicago or New York or someplace, recognize that everything that's there has been given to you by nature, but also at some cost. And, you know, we're exploring so many avenues now to turn our cities into more natural environments. You know, one of the concepts, just as one of many examples, is the idea that we could get rid of cars in the city. We could turn all the big parking garages into gardens, because plants don't, they need sunlight, but that doesn't have to be direct. You can direct it in with mirrors. So you can catch the sunlight outside and direct it into these gardens and pass it all through the garden with a whole series of mirrors. That's one example. And I think people are looking at these sorts of things, and there's a lot of urban gardens outside too in places these days, areas being created for that. So there's many ways to look at this, but people who don't have the opportunity to participate in those things, at the very least, to incorporate into their value system a gratitude toward the materials that went into creating where they live and what they do and the sidewalks they walk on, to always feel that you're part of that, to feel your feet on the earth, you know, and to listen to the sounds. And you can hear there are birds in the cities, and listening to the sounds, listening to the wind, feeling the sun, feeling the air, tasting the air. You know, you can stick your tongue out and taste the air. It tastes different in different places. Smells, to be really aware of that, what we call being totally sensuous into our senses, as not necessarily sensual, which implies a certain sexuality, but sensuous, which is inviting the senses to be a deep part of your life.
I think that's, again, like really expanding on this concept of how do we reconsider our relationship with our environments, despite them not explicitly looking like the natural world, and you know, again, like practicing that sense of gratitude to really kind of connect on that deep level, as we've kind of talked about before. So this kind of, you know, takes us to the close of the podcast, John, and I wanted to kind of close with one final question. Of all the ideas and happenings going on in the world and the work that you're doing, it's a clear imperative for us to take active engagement in changing the current systems as they are. Despite all the moving parts and the uncertainty about the future, what gives you hope?
My grandson, who's 14 years old, and his generation, and young people around the world. Before the pandemic, I was traveling. I was speaking in China and Kazakhstan and Russia and all over Latin America and Europe and elsewhere. And during the pandemic, virtually, and everywhere I go and people I hear everywhere are thinking along these same lines, and the younger generation especially. And I was deeply impressed by the younger people in China who have experienced terrible pollution and don't want it to continue. They told me with no shadow of a doubt, they've got to end this pollution. And we in the United States can think what we want about China and its coal plants and its relationship to Russia and so on and so forth. And it's all that's true. There's some bad things going on. But the younger generations there and in this country are really looking at this issue. You don't have to convince them there's climate change. They know it. They totally know it. I've had to convince almost of my, you know, that since I've known about climate change, which has been only relatively, you know, the end of my, you know, the last 20 years or so, where we've really been talking about this, to convince people my age that there is climate change. But you don't have to do that with young people. My grandson, he's an all-A student, and he can deal with computers and all that stuff very, very well, but he doesn't spend much time on it. He does not do a lot of gaming. He's a skateboarder, and he likes to get out in nature. He loves to get out in nature, and I think that does reflect an awful lot of the generation. We hear about kids being glued to their computers and gaming, and that's there too. But I think that's a passing. I hope it's a passing phenomena that they at the same time are understanding the importance of change, of transforming a life economy to a death economy. That gives me hope. You give me hope. The fact that you're doing this gives me hope. And I know, Grace, that you're a lot younger than me. I don't know how old you are, but I know you're a lot younger than me. And your generation gives me hope. And so does the older generation. Now we're catching on too. Is you know, the elders can mentor the younger people who are ready to be mentored, I think. And yet we're up against, I think there's a consciousness revolution in the world. That's what I sense. That's what I know. No matter where I go, you feel this bubbling up. But at the same time, whenever there's a revolution, there's a pushback. That's always been true. And so the people who represent the status quo don't want there to be change. So they push back, but we take strength from that. You know, during the American Revolution, and when I love the stories of the American Revolution, that was all about perception, incidentally. So in 1774, the whole of the North America, whole of North America, that was the colonies, believed that the British were invincible. It was a perception. George Washington came along and he remembered in 20 years earlier during the French and Indian War, how the crack British force under General Braddock, a huge British force, was defeated by a much smaller force of Indians and led by some French soldiers at the Battle of the Monongahela. And George Washington said to the Continental Congress, he said, they're not invincible. The British are not invincible. All we got to do is hide behind trees. And that was a total change of perception. And, you know, and that change meant everything. And, you know, that throughout the whole process, at the beginning, Thomas Jefferson estimated, and recent historians feel that that was pretty accurate, that a third of the people of the United States were in favor of the revolution, a third were totally opposed to it. They were what we call Tories, opposed to it, and a third didn't care. But the perception then began to change. It began, and as the perception changed, so did the reality of the war. And so, you know, I think what we're seeing today, and every time the British pushed back harder, came in stronger, the perception of the Americans changed even more. Nobody likes to be pushed. And we're at this point in time now where there's this consciousness revolution and there's a pushback against it. The status quo are pushing back against it. We can take strength from that. They're pushing back because they know they're losing. They know this can't continue. They know climate change can't go on, but they don't want to lose what they think they've got. They don't understand that they too will gain from this in their own different ways. So what gives me hope is this consciousness revolution and the power that it's growing and growing and growing. And I think, you know, the pandemic has taught us not only that we can change, but we can enjoy the change, parts of it. And, you know, despite all the tragedies around it and all the suffering people have gone through, there's a lot of people have learned new things from the pandemic. There has been change and there's been an enjoyment in some of that change. I know people have learned to play the flute or written the book they've always thought they needed to write or whatever because of it.
Thank you, John. That is just such an amazing way to wrap up. I think there's so many lessons that can be taken from today's discussion about, you know, pushing through despite resistance and forces that are really trying to, you know, kind of deter us from making the impact that's going to help everybody on the planet. I'm going to hand off the floor to ECASYS President Philip Clayton to close us out for today. Philip?
Our guest on the podcast today has been John Perkins. If you'd like to learn more about John and his work, you can purchase his books on all major digital bookstore platforms. We encourage you to visit his website, johnperkins.org, where you can sign up for the monthly newsletter. Or you can connect with John on social media. His handle on Instagram, for example, is at jperkinsauthor. Thanks to our audience for tuning in, and be sure to be on the lookout for our next episode coming out soon.